Campus FM presents the first talk by Professor David Cooper, entitled Meaning, Language and the Understanding of Cultures.
The questions I want to raise about meaning are very much set in the context of anthropological inquiry, by which I mean inquiry in that attempts to understand different cultures, their practices and beliefs. So it's social or cultural anthropology I have in mind, not so-called physical anthropology, where you look at the jawbones of cavemen and things like that. We're more concerned with the understanding of beliefs, practices, rituals, languages, and so on. Well, specifically, I want to raise over the next couple of days, tonight and tomorrow, sort of four questions concerning meaning set in this anthropological context. And the first question is this: I mean, do anthropologists, more generally social scientists, do they need to employ the notion of meaning in their attempt to understand other cultures? Is meaning something that, you know, anthropology must inquire into, or can it bypass it? Well, second, if the answer to that question is anthropologists must employ the notion of meaning in their inquiries, that raises the question, what is meaning? Or at any rate, what's the idea or notion of meaning that anthropologists, sociologists, and so on need to employ? Then third, I want to raise certain questions about the relevance of meaning to certain well-known disputes that you find among anthropologists. Can reflection on meaning help us to settle some of those disputes? In particular, I'm thinking of the following issue. It's an old issue, but still a live one. You know, can cultures be so radically different from our own, so alien to our own, that there just can't be any serious comparison between the beliefs, values of that culture and our own? I mean, one reason I think that issue is an important one is because it's, you know, very relevant to the whole issue of so-called cultural relativism. Because I think what a lot of so-called cultural relativists argue is something like this. They say, look, truth, value can only be relative to cultures. And that's because cultures can be so different from one another that there's, as it were, no sensible comparison that can be made between them. They are, to use a familiar term in this kind of area of discourse, cultures can be incommensurable. There's no common measure by which we can adjudicate whether, as it were, their belief system is more sensible than ours, or vice versa. And then finally, a final issue about meaning I want to look at is to ask about the nature of a certain, if you like, mode or kind of meaning that gets particularly discussed, I think, by anthropologists, what we might call figurative or metaphorical, at any rate, non-literal meaning. and for reasons which shall emerge as we go along, you know, that kind of meaning is of particular interest to anthropologists. Okay, so before I get going and start looking at those questions, a sort of methodological point, really asking you to do something in order, as it were, sort of to join in. It'll be very useful, I think, when we think about the questions I've just raised. It'd be very useful if you could put yourself in the position of what's sometimes called the radical interpreter. And by a radical interpreter, I mean somebody who's trying to understand another culture, and a culture that's just very strange to him or her. One about which the interpreter, the anthropologist, you know, can't make any assumptions as to what these people think or value. So, you know, you wouldn't be a radical interpreter if you, you know, went off for a holiday in Italy. Because, you know, if you go to holiday in Italy, you're justified in making all kinds of assumptions about what Italians think and value and care about and so on. You'll make some mistakes, probably. You know, maybe you'll misunderstand certain gestures that Italians make, but by and large, you can go to Italy fairly confident that they're not that different from you. So you need to put yourself, I think, in the position, imaginatively, of, you know, somebody who's just been, of an anthropologist who's just been parachuted in, to some recently discovered, remote, exotic tribe in the jungles of Brazil. Or put yourself in the position of one of those tribesmen coming over here. I think how puzzled that tribesman might be by, for example, the behavior of football fans, or by ceremonies such as baptism. And if you can put yourself in the position of the radical interpreter, that's useful, I think, because you're then forced to think about what starting from scratch, from the ground up, you're going to need to know and understand in order to understand another culture. Well, someone, you know, I think who was in something like that position, not so radical, you know, was the author Karen Blixen. I'm sure quite a few of you have read her 1937 book, Out of Africa, and probably even more saw the Meryl Streep movie version of it. And I want to quote a couple of passages, which are also quoted in this book, for those of you who are going to use it. I want to quote a couple of passages from this book, which I'll be sort of coming back to throughout the course of my two talks. And both passages concern, you know, what to Karen Blixen, at least, seems a great difficulty in understanding sort of native local behavior. I mean, Karen Blixen was, you know, married a Danish aristocrat who farmed in Kenya, and she stayed on farming in Kenya even after she got divorced from him. And she lived among the sort of Kikuyu people of Kenya. The first passage, here she's, you know, addressing a certain puzzle that she finds many of her European white friends experience about the Kikuyu. as some of these Europeans perceive it, that the Kikuyu are just very strangely and irrationally scared of sort of white people. And Blixen writes, I myself think that they were afraid of us more in the manner in which you're afraid, say, of a sudden terrific noise. And yet it's difficult to tell, for the Kikuyu are great at the art of mimicry, and in the end their behaviour towards us might be some sort of strange joke, and perhaps these shy people are not afraid of us at all. And then in the second passage, there's another sort of view that Europeans have expressed to her that she's addressing, at this time concerning what seems to the Europeans, at least, a great lack of gratitude on the part of Kikuyu tribespeople when, for example, they're given presents. The Europeans complain that the Kikuyu natives know nothing of gratitude, and that it's the same whatever you do to them. And this is an alarming quality. It seems to annul your existence as an individual, as if you were a phenomenon of nature, like the weather. You know, just as you don't express gratitude to the weather just because it's a nice day, so it seems the Kikuyu don't express gratitude towards you when you give them a nice present. Well, you know, what both these passages indicate, don't they, are a real difficulty in understanding the behaviour of another culture. And the two passages have something in common, because the question is raised in both passages as to whether the Kikuyu really regard Europeans, Westerners, as persons at all. As Blixen suggested, it can seem as if they treat you more like a natural phenomenon, or as like the weather, or perhaps as just sophisticated animals. Well, as I say, you know, those two problems of interpretation raised by Blixen are ones I'll come back to occasionally in the light of points that I raise in these talks. Okay, you know, the first question I mentioned was this. You know, do anthropologists have to employ the idea of meaning, significance, when they're trying to understand the behavior and practices of another culture? And it might seem pretty obvious to you that they do. I mean, surely to understand cultural practices, attitudes, and so on, you need to know what people mean. So that social scientists, anthropologists, you know, have to focus on the meanings expressed by native gestures, rituals, or whatever. Nevertheless, it's often been denied by social scientists that social science needs to employ the idea of meaning. Denied, for example, by so-called positivists in the 19th century, like Auguste Comte, and by 20th century behaviorists and functionalists in the social sciences. And, you know, their line of thought is something like this, that if you want to be truly scientific, then you, the social scientist, must emulate the natural scientists, physicists, biologists, and so on. In particular, you should confine your attention solely to what's publicly observable. And therefore you should ignore what might or might not be going on in the heads, in the minds of the people that you, the social scientists, are observing. Ideas, meanings, are inaccessible to proper controlled observation. And hence the social scientist should restrict himself, herself, to trying to establish general patterns or laws of observable behaviour through close observation of regularities in people's behaviour. In anthropology, this so-called positivistic attitude, you know, took the form of what's often called functionalism. And the idea is something like this, that, you know, to understand a native practice is to see what functional role that practice plays in the society in question. For example, it might be suggested, indeed it was, that, you know, to understand a gift exchange system is to understand how the practice of exchanging gifts serves to cement social relationships, especially relationships between families connected through marriage. Another example, the Italian economist, sociologist Pareto, you know, argues that if you want to understand the ritual of baptism, you've got to see it as a purification rite. And to understand purification rites is to understand their role in society in distinguishing some groups of people from others in a social hierarchy. So, you know, what goes on, if anything, in the minds of the actors, the natives you're studying, is irrelevant. To understand their behavior, all you need to do is to identify the functional role of the behavior in question. So, on this approach, what Karen Blixen should have been doing in order to understand the Kikuyu's apparent lack of gratitude, what she should have been doing is to have made a careful comparative statistical study of the functional role in traditional farming societies of the giving and receiving of gifts. And what she might have found out, perhaps, is that, you know, giving and receiving gifts and expressing gratitude is something that only goes on within the tribe, cementing their identity, setting them apart from the foreigners, the European farmers like Blixen herself. Well, okay, so, you know, there's this line of thought which denies that there's any need even to invoke the notion of meaning in understanding cultural practices and belief systems and so on. But I think it's a pretty implausible approach. And I want to just mention two reasons why I think this is implausible and why, therefore, the anthropologists, social scientists more generally, do need to operate with the notion of meaning. They need to understand the meaning and significance of what they're studying. And the first reason has to do with language. It seems pretty obvious, doesn't it, that, you know, complex, sophisticated practices like exchanging gifts, or marriage, or baptism, such practices necessarily involve the use of language on the part of those who engage in them. That is, it's very hard, isn't it, to imagine a society or a culture in which such complex, sophisticated practices occurred, where nevertheless language was missing. They didn't actually have a language. You know, for one thing, you know, these complex practices are only going to work if people agree on how the practices should be practiced, on how the rituals should be conducted, and so on. And therefore, there's got to be a method within the society for settling disagreements among people about how the rituals and practices are to be conducted. And it's very difficult to conceive, isn't it, that that could be done in the absence of language. The obvious way in which to raise disagreements and to settle them is to talk about things. Well, if that's right, then there couldn't be a proper understanding of practices and cultures without an understanding of a language which is being used by the people of that culture. And how could there be such a thing as understanding of a language which didn't involve understanding what words mean? Well, okay, there are some sort of hardline behaviorists. Some of you may know, be familiar with the work of the psychologist B.F. Skinner. Hardline behaviorists who have argued that in order to understand a language, you don't have to invoke the idea of word meaning or sentence meaning at all. All you have to do is to know what kind of stimuli prompt people to make certain noises and what the effects of those noises are upon other people. So, you know, a stimulus response model of understanding of the kind that may work for rats can work for human language as well. In effect, for people like Skinner, you can treat a human language as being like the signalling system of certain lower animals like bees. But that, I think, is very implausible, isn't it? You know, a human language is a vastly more sophisticated and complex thing than anything like the signalling system of bees. I'll give you at least one argument for why I think this view is implausible. And this appeals to a very well-known thought experiment in the relevant literature, a thought experiment of the American philosopher John Searle. And it's called the Chinese Room argument. Suppose you've got a Chinese computer, with a very advanced program which enables the computer to replicate very well at least some of the speech abilities, linguistic abilities of fluent Chinese speakers. So, you know, if you type certain Chinese characters into the computer will generate the same outputs as native Chinese speakers. It'll, for example, combine the characters into proper grammatical sequences, and so on. Now, suppose somebody, like Searle himself, in, as it were, in the thought experiment, decides, as it were, that he, in turn, will replicate the computer. So what he does is this. He arms himself with lots of pencils and notepads and shuts himself in a room. And somebody, and he has with him, crucially, an English language manual describing the computer program of the Chinese computer. So he goes into this room, and people slip little bits of paper under the door with Chinese characters written on them. And what Searle then does is to look up in this big, thick manual at what you can do with these characters, what combinations you can put them in, and so on. And although it takes him a long time to do this, in effect, he does the same thing as the computer. Given a certain input of Chinese characters, he produces outputs which are just like those that native fluent Chinese speakers would produce. And then Searle asks the question, does he therefore understand Chinese? And his answer is, no, of course I don't. I don't know what a single Chinese word or character means. And his point is this, that the mere fact that somebody responds accurately and appropriately to certain, as it were, stimuli, to certain inputs, and produces appropriate outputs, that doesn't even begin to show that the person or the machine, the computer, actually understands the language in question. Just because you can replicate the behavior of somebody who understands Chinese doesn't mean that you or the machine understands Chinese. And so, you know, what Searle's example is supposed to persuade us of, and I think it is, it does sound quite persuasive, is that, you know, any account of linguistic understanding which doesn't involve the idea of grasping meanings, any account which just tries to describe linguistic understanding in terms of inputs and outputs, stimuli and responses, isn't going to work. There's a second reason I want to mention why it seems to me that, like it or not, anthropologists and social scientists have to invoke and employ the notion of meaning when trying to understand other cultures and societies. And this is an argument you find at least implicit in the writings of the famous Austrian philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. And it's spelled out in some detail by one of Wittgenstein's followers and admirers, Peter Winch, in a book, influential book, called The Idea of a Social Science. And the argument actually is a quite simple one. And it goes like this, you know, according to positivists and functionalists and behaviorists, you can understand why people are doing the things they do without hauling in notions like meaning and significance. But, says Wittgenstein or Winch, unless you employ the idea of meaning and significance, unless you can identify the meaning or significance that actions and have for people, you don't even know what it is that they're doing, let alone why they're doing it. In other words, even to identify the actions that people are performing, you've got to have some grasp of what those actions signify for the agents, the actors. And the underlying thought here, I think, is the following one, that, you know, activities and practices like, say, exchanging gifts or baptizing children, these are not simply bits of physical, of overt physical behavior. You know, when the postman hands me a package, his overt physical behavior may be no different from yours when you give me my Christmas present. But you're giving me a gift, the postman isn't, even though physically the two of you, as it were, are doing the same thing. And, you know, baptizing a child isn't simply a matter of dousing its head with some water. You could do that to a child for all sorts of reasons, having nothing to do with baptism. I mean, what makes my action one of giving you a present or of baptizing a child is a meaning to my action that I appreciate and grasp. And Winch has a lot of, quite persuasive example of, you know, bad explanations of actions throughout the history of anthropology, which are bad precisely because the anthropologists in question are assimilating very different kinds of actions or practices just because they look similar. In physical terms, they haven't, as it were, properly inquired into the very different significance or meaning that these forms of behavior may have for different people in different contexts. I mean, for example, I don't think this is Winch's example, but I mean, take cannibalism. You know, on the surface, you know, just looking at a cannibal eating, that doesn't seem any different in principle from what you're doing when you sit down and have a steak or a pork chop. It's just that the cannibal is eating a human chop or steak. He's having his dinner, just as you are. But is he? And this is the point, isn't it, that once you actually start inquiring closely into a practice like cannibalism, you find that describing the cannibal as having his dinner, you know, is completely inappropriate. When a cannibal, say, eats the heart of a warrior, an enemy warrior that he's slain, it's not because he's a bit peckish and, you know, can't find a hamburger. It has a totally different significance and meaning. So, you know, that's to exemplify, albeit in a rather dramatic, exaggerated form, the point that, you know, just because two sets of behaviour might look similar in overt physical terms, they might be totally different practices or actions, and that's because the significance, meaning attached to these behaviours by the practitioners is completely different. So I'm going to take it then that anthropologists, social scientists do need, can't avoid invoking and employing the idea of meaning and significance when they attempt to identify and explain the behavior of the societies they're inquiring into. But this, of course, now raises the question of, you know, what is meaning? What is it to identify meaning and significance? In a while, I mean, perhaps not till tomorrow, I'm not sure. In a while, I'm going to suggest a view of meaning, one I argue for in that little book. But before that, I want to look at a couple of well-known approaches to meaning, if you like, to well-known theories of meaning, which seem to me, if not exactly wrong, that at any rate one-sided or perhaps exaggerated. I'm first, the very traditional view, it might even for all I know be the common sense view. It's often called a sort of mentalism, sometimes ideationism. And it's the idea, put crudely, that the meanings of words, gestures, or whatever are, as it were, in the head, in the mind. And it's this sort of view of meaning which I think was under attack from the positivists, who complained that, you know, meanings are private and inaccessible, buried inside people's heads, and therefore not scientifically respectable. And I think, you know, at least in their critical point, the positivists, have a point. Because while I think there must be some kind of connection between meaning and mind, I think the idea that you understand a word, a statement, a gesture, or whatever, when you grasp some internal mental item, an image, say, or an idea, that view, I think, that claim is problematic. I think the idea that meanings are in the head doesn't stand up to scrutiny. There are a number of arguments which I could employ here. I think I'm just going to mention one. And it has to do with, as it were, context, the context or situations, the worldly environment in which people speak and gesture and so on. There's another sort of famous thought experiment in the relevant philosophical literature, this time due to another American philosopher called Hilary Putnam, who's a he, not a she, despite the name. And this is the so-called twin earth argument. And what it's designed to show, this thought experiment, is that, you know, meanings, as Putnam puts it, just ain't in the head. Because what he wants to try and show in this thought experiment is that what's going on in the heads of two speakers may be exactly the same, for all we know, but nevertheless we can be quite certain that their words mean different things. And the thought experiment goes like this. Imagine that there's a planet, he calls it Twin Earth, which is actually, at least on the surface, very like our planet. Things look the same, taste the same, smell the same. There are creatures who, to all intents and purposes, look just like human beings and speak, even speak English on Twin Earth. In particular, they've got the word, like we have, water. When we use the word water, we have certain sort of ideas and images associated with it, don't we? It's generally speaking, transparent, tasteless. If it's very cold, it'll freeze, so on and so on. This is the way we understand water. And it's just the same on Twin Earth. Twin Earthers associate just the same images and ideas with their word water as we do. And so if you were chatting to a Twin Earther, you very reasonably assume that both of you meant exactly the same by the word water. But it turns out there's a big difference. Twin Earth is very like Earth, except in its chemistry. It has an entirely different chemistry to Earth. And in particular, what they call water on Twin Earth isn't H2O. It's some other chemical compound unknown to us on Earth. Now, says Putnam, look, when we on Earth speak about water, we're referring to that stuff H2O. But on Twin Earth, when they use the word water, they're not referring to H2O. They're referring to something entirely different, to an entirely different chemical compound or stuff. And, says Putnam, surely that just shows, doesn't it, that they don't mean the same by their word water as we do. And how could they? How could their word water mean the same as ours when our word refers to one sort of stuff and their word refers to an entirely different sort of stuff? And then Putnam's final conclusion is, you know, it doesn't matter what, if anything, is going on in the heads of Earth speakers and Twin Earth speakers, what ideas, images they may associate with the word water. Because whatever's going on, even if it's exactly the same in the two cases, their word water means something quite different from ours. So, you know, what's meant by a word isn't determined and can't be determined by the images, ideas, or other mental occurrences going on in the heads of speakers. Okay, we started late, so only sort of 5 minutes, I think. I want to end, you know, today's talk by looking at another very familiar view of meaning, if you like, an attempt to define the notion of meaning, which once again seems to me, although it may have an element of truth in it, is at the very least exaggerated or one-sided. And this is the idea, I think, that when you inquire into what words or gestures or whatever mean, you're essentially asking, what rules are being followed here? What rules govern the employment of the word or the making of the gesture? And certainly, this idea that the key to understanding the notion of meaning is the notion of a rule, or at any rate a convention, that's a very popular approach. Winch, for example, says in his book, The Idea of a Social Science, that, words and actions are intelligible, they can be understood, because they're governed by their own rules. And if you want to understand what people mean by words or actions, uncover the rule that they're following. Well, as I say, I think there are elements of truth in this approach. I mean, to begin with, I think, the suggestion fits certain cases. I mean, take things like, I'm saying cheers when you raise a glass, or buon appetito at the beginning of a meal, or perhaps reciting amen at the end of a church service, or a football referee putting up a red card when one player has kicked the legs from underneath another player. Now, arguably, all that's involved in understanding each of those utterances or actions is grasping the rule or convention that governs it. There's a convention in Italy that at the beginning of a meal, people say buon appetito to each other. In Britain, when you are drinking with somebody, there's a convention, if not a rule, that you say cheers, and so on. To understand the significance of the red card in a football game is simply to understand a certain rule of football, which requires a player to leave the field when the referee makes this gesture. The second element of truth, I think, in this approach is that I think it does make the very important point that meaning is what you might call a normative notion. Let me explain. To know what certain words, for example, mean, isn't to know simply when they're produced, what their effects are, and so on. It's to know as well when it's legitimate to produce these words, when it's permissible to apply them in certain ways, or to combine them with other words. So when I say that meaning is a normative notion, I mean that somebody who understands the meanings of gestures, words, or whatever, he understands things like the legitimacy or the permissibility or perhaps the obligation to use words, make gestures in certain ways. And that's, I think, a very important thought. But, nevertheless, it seems to me that, the idea of meaning as rule-governed is too narrow or exaggerated. I mean, for a start, I think most utterances or statements people make, aren't either required by or forbidden by rules. They're not like buon appetito or cheers. I mean, there's a convention, as it were, requiring you to say something. But there's no convention, is there, let alone a rule, dictating that I should be now uttering the words I'm uttering to you. There's no convention, either in the UK or in Malta, that, you know, somebody utters on certain occasions sentences like the very sentence I'm speaking now. But what about words, particular words? I mean, could you argue that to know their meaning is to know a rule for applying and combining the words? So that, you know, to understand the word dog or whatever is to know the rule for applying that word and for combining that word with other words. Well, I think the answer is no. I mean, language is just too flexible, too context-sensitive for us to speak at all generally of rules governing how words should be applied and combined. The famous, notorious, sort of deconstructivist French philosopher Jacques Derrida, many of his articles and writings are sort of emphasizing this kind of point. He says, for example, that, you know, we're continually finding ourselves in, as he puts it, infinitely new contexts, different from any contexts or situations we've been in before. And what's required in these contexts, by way of speaking, isn't sort of looking up a rule book for what you should say and what you shouldn't say. What you require are things like skills in improvisation. You need to exercise imagination, sensitivity, and so on. In other words, human speech, unlike, say, the languages of certain artificial languages of computers, human speech is not, one might say, robotic. Human beings, I think, have a remarkable degree of flexibility and freedom in how they speak. And this is ignored, underplayed by the emphasis on words as being governed by rules. I mean, for example, an example I give in the book, when is it okay to apply the simple word green to a simple thing like a leaf? Well, I think the answer is in any number of different circumstances in which it's, you know, in context, perfectly proper to say that leaf is green. For example, if the leaf is green, you can say the leaf is green. Supposing, though, it's been painted green, well, in an appropriate context, you can say the leaf is green. It was silver, now it's been painted green. Or maybe in saying the leaf is green, all you want to convey in the context is that it looks green because of a certain artificial light which is being shone on it. And so on and so on. And it seems to me that, you know, you just can't determine in advance by applying some rule when it would be okay and intelligible to apply the word green to a leaf. Or to take, finally, a more exciting kind of example, think of the way in which over the last few years, words like sort of married, husband, parent how these words have adapted to and reflect previously unpredicted developments, gay marriages, surrogate motherhood, IVF, and so on. Now, it seems to me interesting that, you know, people do speak of gay marriages. You know, irrespective of whether this is something they're in favor of or not. In other words, the term marriage has adapted to cover the joining together of two males or two females. And what I think this suggests is that here you have what would have been, at least to people in the 19th century, a totally unpredicted social development. And yet, you know, the word marriage adapts to this new context, as Derrida would call it. And it would seem to me to get, as it were, the flavour of a natural language like English wrong, to think of its words, with certain exceptions, like mathematical symbols perhaps, to think of its words as sort of governed by rules. So, you know, in conclusion, it seems to me that despite certain elements of truth, the suggestion that to understand meaning is to understand the rules which govern the employment of words, gestures, and so on, isn't right, any more than the idea that meanings are in the head was an acceptable approach. And so what I want to do tomorrow is briefly sketch what seems to me a more cogent conception of meaning, and then return, armed with that, to issues in social anthropology, including the issue that I flagged up at the beginning about whether we can really accept that cultures could be so different from one another as to defy mutual understanding. Right, thank you. That's a coffee time. So.
You have just listened to the first talk by Professor David Cooper entitled Meaning, Language and the Understanding of Cultures.